For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Tygon's teaching, please visit us at ancientdragon.org.
So I know most of you, but I'm Laurel Ross, and I'm one of the practitioners here. And sometimes Tygon gives a talk, and sometimes guest teachers give a talk, and sometimes we students give the talk. So tonight it's my turn. And I am going to talk about women ancestors. So in Zen practice, we give a lot of attention to our ancestors. And sometimes we chant them, usually in Sesshin, we chant them, and we start back from Shakyamuni Buddha. And then we go through the Indian ancestors, and then Chinese ancestors, and Japanese ancestors, until we finally get to Suzuki Roshi, who's the Japanese priest who, in 1959, brought Soto Zen to the U.S. and started what is now the San Francisco Zen Center. And, of course, our teacher comes from that lineage. So I have always really loved this ritual of chanting the names of the ancestors. Tonight we did the women names of our women ancestors, and something about the sheer number of them and knowing that that represents a generation helps me just realize, and in a palpable way, the sheer length of that this practice has been. 2,500 years ago. It's sort of a stunning idea that we could trace ourselves all the way back to Shakyamuni, but of course, it's something of a fiction that it is a literal tracing, because the whole idea of tracing ancestors really emerged not till like 1,000 years later in China, when the sort of the influence of Confucianism and very strong emphasis on ancestors. And so then there was careful recording of this transmission of teacher to student, this one-on-one practice, and then sort of a reconstructing backwards to the historical Buddha, knowing all the many of the teachers. And so it's sort of real but not literally true. And so this will be a great thing for lots of Dharma talks, but I'm not going to talk about that. I really wanted to talk about the women ancestors, because last May we had a practice commitment period of 8 weeks, and part of the practice commitment period for the people that signed up for it was we had several discussion groups, and we were reading some material, and then we also just talked about any questions that came up in our practice. And one of the questions that came up was, why is it mostly the male ancestors that we hear the stories about? And so that discussion got a little traction, and it was sort of interesting, and we sort of said, well, we should talk more about that sometime, but we didn't really have time to pursue it then. So I started thinking about it and looking at some materials, and there's some women that we talk about, like we always talk about Maha Prajapati, who's Buddha's aunt. His mother, Maya, died shortly after he was born, and he was raised by his aunt, who was also married to his father. It's a different culture. But anyway, we don't know a lot of names. So, I wanted to say, my experience in Zen practice has been that it's been egalitarian when it comes to gender. We're about half and half tonight, men and women. We sit together. Women are priests. Women are abbots. Women are tenzos and teachers and so forth. Actually, in one regard, there have been many fewer scandals when it comes to women teachers, so no mystery there. There's usually some sexual misconduct involved. So, but anyway, it's not about that so much as it is about exploring all the parts of our culture that are accessible to us and just having access to it and learning from it. And so anyway, we chanted the names of the women ancestors tonight, and if you go on the website, there is a short biography of each one of those. It's really a lot of names, as you know. And I thought I'd just read you a couple just to give you a flavor of what it is. It's pretty interesting. So Patakara from India, here's what it says about her. After her children, parents, and husband died, she went mad from grief and wandered the countryside. Eventually, she met the Buddha, who calmly told her to recover her presence of mind, and thus she was cured. She became a highly influential teacher who brought many women to the Dharma and had many disciples. Gongxi Daoren, so she died in 1124 in China. She was a nun, teacher, and poet. She wrote The Record on Clarifying the Mind, which circulated throughout China. She was well married, but left her husband, asking her parents to allow her to be ordained, but they refused. And thereafter, she practiced in solitude. She was awakened after reading the Huayan patriarch Dushan's Contemplation of the Dharma Dhatu. After her parents' death, she ran a bathhouse and wrote Dharma poetry on the walls to engage her customers. I love that. And finally became a nun in old age. One more. So Rionen Gensho, 1646 to 1711 in Japan. She became a nun at 26, leaving behind her husband and children. She entered the Rinzai training monastery, Hokyoji, but was denied ordination by two masters because her beauty would distract the monks. So she burned her face with a poker and was then ordained by Hakuo. He certified her enlightenment, and she became abbot of Renjoin and a respected poet. So there's a lot more of them there, and they're, those even aren't the most dramatic stories of them. It's really a rich and interesting set of information. So I've been sort of looking at what there is to read about this, and I thought I'd share some of those with you, and we can leave them in the library and so forth. I thought I'd start with a little bit from an essay by a woman named Judith Reutemann. She wrote a pretty famous essay maybe 15 years ago, called Women, Zen Ancestors, A Second Take. And she's pretty interesting. She's a mathematics professor at Kansas University, and she's the guiding teacher at the, and she's a poet, and she's the guiding teacher at the Kansas Zen Center, which she and her husband founded. And here's a little bit from her essay. When I started Zen practice over 30 years ago, most of us knew little or nothing about our female ancestors. Barbara Rhodes had just gotten Inca, which is authorization to teach, one of the first Western women Buddhist teachers. Most of us figured this was a great anomaly in Buddhist life. It was even said by many Western practitioners in many branches of Buddhism that the great contribution the West would make to Buddhism would be the inclusion of women. Gary Snyder wrote in his Zen Center's newsletter how amazing it was that they'd had a retreat in which half of the participants were women. Never before had so many women practice, which shows how ignorant we were and how arrogant. So in 1991, Susan Murcutt's book, that's this one, The First Buddhist Women, appeared. And then in 1993, Rita Gross's book, which I don't have, Buddhism After Patriarchy. And Reutemann says, this material wasn't new to scholars, but it was new to many and perhaps most Western practitioners. The reaction by many in the Buddhist community was a kind of joyous shock. mini courses sprung up. Women's lineages were constructed, as the one we did tonight. We had women ancestors after all, so that's just a little bit of sort of recent history of sort of the rediscovery that this this in fact was true, and it's just that we hadn't been aware of it. And I should say that Chicago's had this women's Buddhist conference for maybe a dozen years or so, and it used to be pretty big. It was at DePaul. It still happens. Beth, I think Jerry is one of the organizers of it, but now it's much smaller. And it was actually a pretty interesting conference. Hundreds of people attended and had all different traditions represented. And that is where I discovered there's this huge literature on this topic. I started to do a bibliography, which I'm happy to share with anyone. But anyway, so I brought a few books. So one is this one, Daughters of Emptiness, Poems of Chinese Buddhist Nuns by Beata Grant. And it has, this is just a lovely, lovely book, I would say. This is a good bedside table book. She's just a superb scholar, and she has chosen and translated these Chinese Buddhist nuns' poems. And I'm actually going to read you one. Let me just go through the books first so I don't get myself confused. So that's one book. There's Zen Women. That's this Grace Shirazan. So she is a Dharma heir of Mel Weitzman and Kato Roshi. Then there's one called Hidden Lamp, which isn't actually published yet. Taigen had a pre-publication copy, which he lent me. And he wrote a recommendation for it. I'll talk about that really briefly. And that's by Florence Kaplow and Susan Moon. And then this one, First Buddhist Women. Caitlin found this in a used bookstore and lent it to me, and I'll have to return it to her after tonight. I love this book. And then the last one is Sally Tisdale. So I'm not going to say a lot about all of them, but I just wanted to give a little sample of them and say that... and then a couple of themes that sort of go through all of them. So one of the things that it says in all of these books, and anywhere you look, is that it was much, much harder for women to become practitioners. And you probably know the story of Huike, who had to like cut off his left arm before Bodhidharma would believe that he was sincere enough to be a student. But this isn't that kind of discouragement. It's really more about the culture, you know, the resistance from society in general, and parents and family and suitors and so forth, that it just wasn't, it was unsuitable for women to be part of this. So that's one of the themes. And then another common theme is that a lot of the stuff has been lost, even though I said there's a huge literature and so forth. All of them say, and we only have a tiny bit. We only have, in Grant's book, she'll say, and we only have one poem from this poet, or we have a record that someone had three books, but we don't know where any of them are. So there's a lot of it is lost. So that's sort of sad, but there's still a lot of good stuff. So anyway, so here's a poem from Grant's book. And so this is by One-Eyed Jingang. So this is a nun who got her name from losing an eye because she read the Diamond Sutra with such single-mindedness that it blew out one of her eyes. Oh. That's a great story. So this is her poem. Male or female, why should one need to distinguish false and true? What is the shape in which Guanyin would finally take form? Peeling away the bodhisattva skin would be of no use whatsoever were someone to ask if it were the body of a man, a woman, or that of a man. So, of course, Guanyin is the Chinese name for Avalokitesvara, the bodhisattva of compassion, who sometimes is presented as male, sometimes female, but takes on many, many forms in order to, benefit many different kinds of sentient beings. So most of these books don't address gender, except sometimes to remind us that it's irrelevant. And she says, Grant says, that the poems are indistinguishable from those composed by Buddhist monks. So they're really sweet, and they, should you read Chinese, it gives the Chinese. She says we lose a lot in the translation because the form is so important to it, but they're still sort of lovely. So Zen Women by Grace Shurison, I'm not even sure I'm pronouncing her name correctly, never heard it said, has just lots of research she's done on lots of different women practitioners all over Asia. I read the whole book. I learned a lot. I actually find this book to be a little shrill, perhaps. That's a little strong. So here's the kind of thing she talks about. She talks about the eight special rules that when the Buddha was approached by his aunt, Mahaprajapati, to ordain her, he said no, and Ananda, his disciple, intervened, and there was a lot of back and forth, and finally Buddha agreed to ordain her and allow her to ordain other women, but they impose special rules in addition to the rules that the monks had. There were lots of rules. And I won't read you all eight of them, but I'll read you a few of them so you'll get the picture, sort of the flavor of them. So nuns, no matter how senior, must always defer to monks, no matter how junior. Nuns must not speak ill of monks. Nuns must not rebuke monks, though monks may scold nuns, etc. That's a little shocking, and I am actually not convinced that when you put quotes around something that Buddha said 2,500 years ago, that's entirely 100% accurate. But I do think those words represented somebody's thoughts within Buddhism that were then attributed to the Buddha. And so other kinds of things she talks about. Shurison contends that Buddha advised his followers in his time to avoid women. Don't see them, Ananda. And if we see them in spite of that, don't speak to them, Ananda. And if they speak to us, practice mindfulness, Ananda. So the idea is that women were sort of seen as a temptation to be avoided. And considering that typically monks were very young men, that seems not surprising. But anyway, that's that book. And I don't mean to be too negative about it, but it wasn't my favorite. But I hope it's going to go on the website. Now I'm going to pick up. So anyway, A.K. Dobin comes off really well in all of these books. So he's quoted from an essay, Attaining the Marrow, saying that Zen needs to be freed from gender stereotypes if it's truly offer complete awakening. And he insists that those monks who maintain conventional and small-minded attitudes, for instance, the banning of women from the holiest temple sites, which was actually true in his time, were just, quote, stupid people who insulted the Dharma. So that is A.K. Dobin. And he also is one of the people in that same essay that recorded the story of two Chinese women Zen practitioners in the lineage that we chanted, Song Qi and Miao Xin. And Song Qi was a disciple of Bodhidharma, and she was one of four people who received Dharma transmission from him. And Shirasen says that it's possible that those women might have been among the lost stories had they not been recorded by Dogen in his essay. So Hidden Lamp, which I don't have, that's the one that is not printed yet. This is a really nice book. One of the editors is Susan Noon, which I know I was going to love this book when I saw her name on it, because she is the author of The Life and Letters of Tofu Roshi. I don't know if you've ever read it. It's the silliest but very funny book about Zen practice. I really recommend it. But anyway, the foreword is written by Norman Fisher, and he says, it's a great relief to have access to this rich material because this has compiled 100 different teaching stories. And then it has a really nice format where they tell the teaching story, and then they have a reflection by a current teacher, Buddhist teacher, and the stories cover a wide range from very, very old to very, very current, and then the commentary is by women of many, many different current traditions all over the world. It's in English, so they were English-speaking, but anyway. And then the other thing that Norman Fisher points out is that the style of teaching, he calls it open-handed teaching, which he contrasts with something he calls the way of the solitary hero, because it recommends, rather than sort of traditional koan study where it's very much between the teacher and student and not discuss outside of that relationship. This book really recommends discussions, and in fact, after the story and the commentary, there are, for each one of those stories, there's discussion questions. So I can tell you one. I don't know how we're doing on time, but here's one called Dipa Ma and the Thief. This is pretty current. This is the Theravadinen, the Vipassana teacher who died in 1989. So this is a 20th century story. You could tell it's a 20th century story because it has a radio and a car. So a student of Dipa Ma had his radio stolen from his car, something that had happened to him several times before. When he told Dipa Ma, she burst out laughing. "What's so funny?" the student asked. Dipa Ma answered, "You must have been a thief in a former lifetime. How many more times do you think you'll need to have your radio stolen? What did you do? What was your reaction when the car was broken into?" And the student replied, "I was really angry because it's happened so many times." She looked at him in amazement. "You mean you didn't even think about the man who took your radio? How sad his life must be?" She closed her eyes and started chanting quietly to herself, offering metta for the thief. So that's the story. And I will not read you all of Heather Martin's reflection because it's quite long, but Heather Martin is a present-day Vipassana teacher. And so just so you get sort of a flavor of the book, her comments are about 2.5 pages. And she says things like, "What I love is how Dipa Ma sees right through the apparently significant what into the underlying forces at play. We're so accustomed to seeing that our happiness depends on getting and keeping our ducks in a row. When they misbehave, get stolen, broken, or lost, we are upset." And goes on to connect it to a personal experience of hers and sort of gives an example of when she unfairly accused someone of a thief. So she found some personal meaning. And then after both of those things, there are several questions here. So how do you remember that someone who hurts you does so out of their own suffering? How is life different as lived with that view? So there are 100 of these in the book. I haven't read them all by any means. But it's a really, I think, maybe it's another bedside book, or maybe it's something that would be useful here for us because it's supposed to be discussed. So I really like that one. And I get the feeling from Taigen that he wrote a very good review of it. So the last book that I want to talk about is my favorite. And this is Susan Murcutt's The First Buddhist Women. And it's a study of the Theragatha, which is a collection of 73 poems in the earliest Buddhist literature. So these are the poems of the wise women of early Buddhism that were passed on in the oral tradition for six centuries before being written down. The sort of thought being that a lot of them were lost in that 600 years. And they were remembered by being chanted in metric form, which served to help being remembered. And I just find them stunningly powerful and really intimate. So I will read one, and I actually made some copies of the two poems and some of the little biographical material. So this is just a fragment of a poem, and it's part of a dialogue between this woman and Mara, bad guy. The whole world is burning. The whole world is in flames. The whole world is blazing. The whole world shakes. But the Buddha taught me the unshakable way. Ordinary people don't practice it, and there is nothing to which you can compare it. When I heard his words, I lived in the joy of the teaching. The three knowledges have been realized. The Buddha's teaching has been done. Everywhere the love of pleasure is destroyed. The great dark is torn apart. And death, you too are destroyed. That's really a strong poem, I think.